8th, and with a new prime minister in place in time for October the 31st's fiscal statement. However, it's surely going to take much more than a speedy election process to restore the nation's lost confidence in the ruling Conservative Party. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's foreign minister Amir Abdullahian has paid a visit to EP House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EP Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the foreign ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Salman Kujurib, Tehran.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this year's long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdulatif Lwashali, Sana'a.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores.
Lots of tough questions. You'd expect that.
I mean, it's quite right that people, you know, are concerned about what happened, concerned about what it means, concerned about the ideology that lies behind it.
A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalised this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology. Muslim activists informed Press TV that locals felt the police had failed to protect their community, leading to a fight back.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organizations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president, Aristide, who was the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty has been regularly subjugated, first by France and then by the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that, and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the prime minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Syed Burizep, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That's what a UN-appointed commission of inquiry has said. The Rights Commission has called on the UN to end Israel's permanent occupation and urges prosecution of Israeli officials. As expected, Tel Aviv rejected the report as being anti-Semitic. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of the report and examine the role of the International Court of Justice and other international bodies in holding Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. Joining us for tonight's discussion, we have manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto. And also from Vancouver, international coordinator at Samarun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Ms. Charlotte Cates.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates in Vancouver. The report by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, which in fact will be presented to the General Assembly later in October, accuses Israel of violating international law by making its control over the West Bank permanent and by annexing land claimed by the Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank and Syrian land in the Golan Heights. Well, there have been many reports in this regard. In your opinion, what makes this report different?
A lot of
ways, this report isn't necessarily different, because we have seen, many, many very good reports published by many good UN commissions and agencies over the years that establish the incontrovertible facts that the Israeli occupation routinely violates international law. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the entire creation of the Zionist project on the land of Palestine, this is an exercise of colonialism. Colonialism itself is illegal under international law. So it really even goes beyond the 1967 military occupation to the nature of the Zionist settler project itself. What it does show, however, is that despite the influence of imperialist states like the United States, Canada, European Union countries, the UK, that there still is a measure of independence, and that the fact is that all of the military, political, and diplomatic support provided for the Zionist project by these states is not able to cover up, obscure, or hide the truth of the matter, which is that the Palestinian cause is a just struggle for justice, liberation, and return, and that on a daily basis, it is Palestinian rights that are being violated by an ongoing, Zionist onslaught of mass imprisonment, extrajudicial killings, occupation, colonization, siege, denial of the right of return, and crimes that go on and on for 74 years.
Farah Sonajian, the report says there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law due to its permanence and the Israelis' de facto annexation policies. And, of course, it says that this should not deprive the occupied power of its statehood nor its sovereignty. When will these condemnations go past just being mere platitudes? When will there be action?
Unfortunately, the United Nations is a biased body, and they have not really done anything for the Palestinian cause. They have never imposed sanctions or passed real resolutions that make real changes and punish and penalize the Zionist war criminal regime and the occupiers of the Holy Land of Palestine. And it's a continuous thing. We've been seeing this for 74 years, and it does not stop. I mean, every month there's some type of aggression. Every few days now it's more constant now, because they feel, there's nobody's going to punish them. The United Nations is quiet. Most of the international key players are quiet as well. And, the ones with the veto power and so on. I mean, few countries are speaking out and putting pressure and supporting the Palestinians. And one of them, obviously, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's why there's a huge campaign to defame them right now and to paint this wrong picture that they're human rights abusers, where they forget about the real human rights abusers is the Zionist regime. How much annexation, how many houses have they stole from Palestinians? And it's been recorded because of this modern technology that we have. How many phones were used to really, highlight these issues of human rights violations? International law is being breached day and night by the Zionist regime. And the thing is, the Zionist regime really just disregards all these bodies because they've never held them really accountable. It's unfortunate, like even when the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was looking to investigate the Zionist regime for war crimes, the former prime minister of the Zionist regime comes out and says this is a kangaroo court. He says we don't even recognize it. So this is the type of rhetoric, this is the type of language these people have. They think they're above the law, they have the state of arrogance. And unfortunately, the only way it seems like it works with the Zionist regime is by military ways and military means. And we've seen that things change once the strength of the Palestinian resistance, hits the Zionist regime. We see that now with Gaza, they negotiate differently, and they pull back and they retract and they become submissive, even though they have all the type of advanced weapons. But this strong united resistance against the Zionist regime, I think, is the only solution. Because if we want to rely on the United Nations, we've seen they haven't done nothing. How come they have always spoke about these issues, have had condemnations and statements, but we haven't seen any real action? But we see now real action on the issue of Russia and Ukraine. How much sanctions have been imposed against Russia? How many meetings, important and emergency meetings have happened in the United Nations to condemn Russia, to impose all types of restrictions and sanctions against Russia and all its officials and so on? And it's only a conflict less than 1 year. We're talking 74 years of occupation. For us as a human rights organization, we don't want to see violence. We don't want to see people dying. We don't want to see, destabilization. But at the end of the day, we have to be logical, and we have to look at things, in a realistic way. And the realistic way is that the Zionist regime is only dealt with and things change when resistance is strong.
Charlotte Cates, that's an issue I wanted to bring up later on in the show, but now that Mr. Najem alluded to it, can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestinians?
Well, I think here it's always really important to talk about who we mean when we say the international community, because by and large, that term is used to mean the imperialist powers that are responsible for creating war, occupation, colonialism, extraction of resources from people around the world. And so the term international community, as if the responsible international community are those who are responsible for the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so the reason why we see a difference in these responses and such a clear and striking difference isn't even that these states are hypocritical or that they have double standards. It's that they have interests, and that their interests are in seeing Zionist colonial power extended in occupied Palestine and dividing the Arab people and dividing the people of the region from one another through the presence of this essentially military colonial project of the Zionist state in occupied Palestine. And so in much the same way, we see that the United States is very much pursuing a war by multiple means against Russia and against any other power that it views as a potential challenger to its domination of the extraction of the resources of colonized and formerly colonized people around the world. And so it's no surprise that these imperialist powers are acting in their interests, but that's not the only international community, and that's not the only international community that matters. Obviously, there are a number of states, including Iran and including Arab states that have not yet conceded to the role of normalization, including resistance forces like we see in Lebanon, and including popular movements and people's movements around the world, both in the global south and the countries that have risen up against colonialism and continue to defend themselves, and in the capitals, the cities, the streets, and the towns of the imperialist powers themselves, that recognize that what is happening in Palestine is, in fact, a grand crime against humanity, and one that is being supported by U.S. imperialism, and one that needs to be brought to an end and to be stopped. And so that's why we are seeing a growth in campaigns to boycott and sanction Israel. And that's why instead what we're seeing are these imperialist powers instead trying to criminalize those boycott movements while saying that it is necessary to use sanctions as kind of a weapon of domination and control against countries from Iran to Russia to really one third of the world are subjected to U.S. sanctions of some form or another. And so it's really necessary to do everything that we can to build up that real international community, that real international community of all of those forces that are involved in resistance to fight back and to stand with the Palestinian people and to stand with the Palestinian resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, because we can't rely on the United Nations. Instead, we have to act and organize.
Firas Al-Najm, the Israelis have rejected this report, obviously, calling its commissioners as being anti-Semitic and questioning their legitimacy. They say the report damages the UN's credibility and its human rights mechanisms. Also, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said that Israel is consistently unfairly targeted in the UN system, including in the course of this commission of inquiry. How hypocritical are these responses?
This is the hypocrisy of the Zionist regime, because it was established on hypocrisy and contradiction. And, you know, this is what they always try to accuse people of, this victim card. And either they play the Holocaust card and try to, you know, play the victim card all the time so, you know, people can have empathy for them. And, you know, they want to justify crimes by looking at crimes that have happened to, let's just say, the Jewish people before. Or they play the anti-Semitic card, you know, and play the victim card again, you know, because they run out of cards now. They're in a very weak state right now, the Zionist regime. So they'll just keep throwing these type of cards around, and they don't get nowhere with them, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, they think they're above the law. Like, when we argue with these people all the time and have different discussions and arguments and protests, we see that their mentality truly is that they believe that they are the chosen people, this is their chosen land, and this is their chosen battle. And they're brainwashed in this kind of manner, you know what I mean? And they don't care about international organizations, and they think that, you know, God is assisting them in this all these criminal activities. But at the end of the day, we know that the resistance will enter Palestine. The resistance is strong, and the axis of resistance is more unified and more experienced now than ever in its history. And like Sayyid Khamenei said, the supreme leader of the Iranian government, he said that the solution is for the West Bank to be armed, as Gaza, just something similar to Gaza, like the same model. Hopefully that will transfer to West Bank. And we see that right now. There is an ignition, and there is this reviving revolutionary lifestyle happening now, where a lot of youth are rising up and fighting back the Zionist regime, while they think they can just, you know, breach the international laws, go into Palestinian territories as they please, break all these, you know, people's houses and things like that. And you know, we're hopeful. I mean, like us, freedom people are defending the people that are oppressed. We are really honestly hopeful that we're going to see a free Palestine in the near future. And it's unfortunate, this hypocrisy, where they're crying about one controversial case such as Mahsa Amini, and then they leave all the dead people that get killed in Palestine, such as Shirin Abu Akla, and all these people that we see clearly how the Israelis don't even care about any humanity at all. They kill women, they kill kids, they kill mothers, grandmothers, you know, and nobody speaks about them. There's no outrage. There's no huge, you know, Twitter hashtags being trended by all these government officials and all these organizations and all these activists. You know, but they focus on that one case because they want to hurt Iran, because Iran is the main supporter of Palestine. And that's what hurts them. They hate a sovereign Iran and a strong Iran supporting the oppressed resistance of Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, the commission demanded the international system and individual states must act and uphold their obligations under international law. That must begin at this session of the General Assembly with the referral to the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued occupation. This is, of course, an excerpt of the report from the commission. How can the ICJ have the leeway to intervene when Israel is not a member of the court and rejects its jurisdiction?
Yes, I mean, and the ICJ has, of course, ruled before on Israeli crimes in 2004, on the building of the apartheid wall. And of course, at the ICC, in addition to what's happening at the ICJ, at the ICC, what we've seen is that, like, for example, legal organizations that are working to bring Palestinians' complaints to the ICC are being branded by the Zionist regime as terrorist organizations, essentially in retaliation for what they're doing to expose the Israeli occupation. We know that these kinds of agencies and even these courts aren't going to act on their own because they're also not apolitical institutions. So, for example, at the ICC, we've seen an announcement that Ukraine, once again, is being prioritized, whereas Palestine has been waiting for justice at the ICC for a very long time. And in fact, the entire decision to handle their case was viewed as controversial and almost at risk at any time. despite the fact that there is an international recognition of a Palestinian state, however limited and insufficient that is. But that, once again, speaks to the fact that we see justice in the courts and in international arenas when we demand and seek justice in the streets and when the Palestinian resistance is organizing, leading, and fighting back. And that's why it is so important that we participate in actions. On October 29th, there's going to be a march in Brussels to the European Parliament to demand an end to the European Union's complicity in ongoing Zionist war crimes and crimes against humanity through, for example, we see the EU-Israel Association Agreement meeting with Israeli occupation leaders, and even when issuing weak criticisms, providing nothing more than strong, fundamentally diplomatic, military, financial, and political support to the Zionist regime. And so we want to encourage people everywhere that you can to support the Palestinian people in their resistance by taking to the streets, by coming out and marching, and by joining us in Brussels on October 29th to march to the European Parliament at 2 p.m.
Firas Al-Najm, the report focused on a very important issue, and that's the issue of settlements, on how Israel has sustained and advanced its quote-unquote settlement enterprise, including statements made by Israeli officials indicating the intent to maintain permanent control over the land in violation of international law. The report also found that land is often confiscated for military purposes, but then used for settlement construction. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Yes, I mean, this is part of their, plan is to weaken the Palestinians and always show them military pieces everywhere, in every corner, so, you know, they can never think that they will ever have their own army and their own state and their own strength and sovereignty. This is one of the main focuses of the Zionist regime, because they know that after they get that strength, then they will start to talk about all the human rights abuses for over these years, all the war crimes. Then they will be talking about compensation, bringing back all the refugees from Palestine. So that means their plan would have to fail, and they won't be able to fully control the land the way that they want to. So this is one of their plans, and it will fail. I think the only type of resolutions we can have to put some pressure, obviously, if the United Nations wakes up actually and really wants to implement the laws truly and put some severe sanctions against Israel, maybe they'll retract a little bit and start to pull away from these settlements. Or the other way is obviously the Palestinian resistance and the rockets, because then, you know, at that point, the settlers and occupiers will feel discouraged and feel, you know, fearful that they have to leave that area because the Palestinians want their land back and they're going to fight for it. And well, like we said, we don't want to see no bloodshed. But if that's the only way it is to acquire your land and to liberate your land, then that's the only way. And it's also it's sanctioned in the Charter of Rights under the United Nations. And any occupied nation has the right to resist, right? And as we see right now, the Ukrainians are getting all types of weapons from Canada, from all types of countries. And it's totally legal and it's totally honorable. But then when somebody wants to help the Palestinians, he's a sponsor of terrorism. It's like Iran supports the Palestinian resistance, inside Gaza, and they call them sponsors of terror. You see the hypocrisy and the biased type of actions is unbelievable, you know. But it's all turning on them anyways, because we're exposing them. We're going out to these politicians and we're asking them, like, if you're supporting Ukraine and you're so proud of that, why don't you support the Palestinians that have been occupied for 74 years? And if you don't believe that they've been occupied, the United Nations says they're occupied, and now we have these little statements here and there that confirm that.
All right, that's all the time we have for this show. Thanks to manager Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and international coordinator Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is the only large wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The US healthcare system ranks last among high-income countries. After the news about the recent drop in US life expectancy, a new survey has found that 56% of the US public believe healthcare in general is handled not too well, or not at all well. Now we have taken a look at the world's media on this issue. Please stay with us. A new survey data, released recently, has shown that about 12% of the American public think healthcare in the United States is handled extremely or very well. Further evidence of the deep unpopularity of a profit-driven healthcare system that has left roughly 30 million Americans without insurance coverage and contributed to the country's stunning decline in life expectancy. The new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll finds that 56% of the American public believe healthcare in general is handled not too well or not at all well, while only 32% believe healthcare is handled somewhat well. In all, just 1 in 10 Americans, or 10%, feel the US healthcare system as a whole and healthcare for older adults are handled well or extremely well. The opinion poll reveals that public satisfaction with the US healthcare system is remarkably low, with fewer than half of the American public saying it is generally handled well, according to an Associated Press report. The opinion poll shows an overwhelming majority of the American public, nearly 8 in 10, or 80%, say they're at least moderately concerned about getting access to quality healthcare in the United States when they need it. The survey results will come as no surprise to those who have attempted to navigate the Byzantine US healthcare system to obtain basic care, which often comes at such prohibitively high costs that millions of people each year are forced to skip medical treatment to avoid financial ruin as insurance giants and pharmaceutical companies rake off huge profits. The Associated Press NORC findings, based on interviews with 1,505 individuals, U.S. adults, between 28th of July and 1st of August 2022, shows that just 6% of the American public feel prescription drug costs are handled well or extremely well in the US, where pharmaceutical firms have broad authority to set prices as they please. As for potential solutions to the country's long-standing healthcare crisis, the new opinion poll shows that about two-thirds of American adults think it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure that all Americans have healthcare insurance coverage, with adults aged between 18 and 49 more likely than those aged over 50 to hold that view. The percentage of people who believe healthcare coverage is a government responsibility has risen in recent years, ticking up from 57% in 2019 and 62% in 2017, according to the Associated Press. More specifically, the opinion survey shows 40% of the American public support a single-payer healthcare system that would require Americans to get their health insurance from a government plan. Depending on how the question is framed and phrased, single-payer, more commonly called Medicare for All, has polled as high as 70% support. According to the Associated Press NORC survey, 58% of the American public say they favor a government healthcare insurance plan that anyone can purchase, a public option. Recent research shows that a Medicare for All system of the kind proposed in new legislation introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Pramila Jayapal, a Democrat from Washington, could have prevented hundreds of thousands of COVID-19 deaths in the United States over the past 2 years. In the richest country in the world, no one should die or go into debt just because they don't have access to healthcare. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, tweeted last week. She added, "We need Medicare for all right now." According to Forbes, some 80% of the American public worry about how they will access good health care, according to a new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research opinion poll, which found the vast majority of the American public are dissatisfied with the system in the United States, one of the only developed nations that doesn't offer universal health care insurance. People of color were more likely than white people to be concerned about accessing good health care in America, with 60% of the black and Hispanic adults concerned about access to health care, compared to 44% of the white population. Some two-thirds of Americans believe it is up to the federal government to ensure people have health care, up from roughly 57% in 2019, according to the survey. But only 40% of the American public say they want a single-payer healthcare system that would mandate Americans get health insurance from the government. More, or 58%, would prefer a government healthcare plan that would be available for anyone to buy, according to the opinion poll. Americans gave an even worse review of how the U.S. handles prescription drug costs, mental health care, and nursing homes. Only 6% of the American public, or even fewer, said they were very satisfied with those services, according to the new opinion poll. 31.6 million Americans, that's how many people didn't have healthcare insurance in 2020. During the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, or nearly 10% of all Americans, according to a survey from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The United States ranks the lowest among the wealthiest nations for its healthcare system, primarily due to a lack of affordability, despite spending the largest percentage of its gross domestic product, or GDP, about 19% of its GDP in 2020, on healthcare services, according to reports. It is one of the only wealthy nations lacking universal healthcare coverage, with the average American spending about $12,500 per person on healthcare costs in 2020.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.